What'll it be?
I was going to fill up with whatever's cheapest.
I'll be happy to take care of that for you.
I thought this was self-serve.
We're completely full service here at Empire State Gas. Sure, it may cost you a bit more, but you're worth it. Now, what else can I get you? Something from the snack shop for you and the little lady?
There is no little lady. I'm alone. And I just ate.
Well, how about a complimentary balloon animal for the kids?
I have no kids, and I'm still alone.
Well, don't feel bad. You may be alone, but you're wise enough to come to the largest independently owned gas station chain in the Northeast United States.
We're in Los Angeles.
I'm sure that you know that our gas is organically grown and good for the environment.
Good for the environment?
That's right. When you burn our fuel, you're actually helping to reverse climate change. That's why we say at Empire State Gas, from farm to pump, we've got great gas.
From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour. I'm leaving.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Dean Haglund, welcome back to Los Angeles.
Oh my God, so good to be back. It's so weird to be back, actually. I'm still jet lagged. It's technically Australian time, 7:26 a.m.
This is the last time you ever need to know what time it is in Australia.
Yes, that's true, I guess. Now it's just universal time.
Universal Studios?
Theme.
What time does Universal Theme Park open? That's all I'm interested in.
9 a.m. every day. Now, here
so
we are.
We begin our tour of historic downtown Los Angeles in one of the most iconic locations.
Absolutely. This is Union Station, built in 1932, overtopped the old Chinatown, which was all torn down.
Moved.
Lifted and moved.
And that's one of the things I want to show you in case you don't know about this, but it's one of my favorite remnants of old Chinatown.
Is still here.
Here on the spot of Union Station. But we are staring at what was the original ticketing concourse,
yes,
right?
Yes, with the high arch ceilings and the California redwoods up there.
And the chandeliers.
Look at those chandeliers.
And this has been and continues to be such a popular filming location.
Yeah.
If you want to see what it looks like...
Filthy
and in disrepair.
Look at Blade Runner.
It's the police headquarters in the original Blade Runner.
Right. If you want to see it clean and from ground level, look at the car commercial with the dancing Santas for... No.
I believe that this was a location of a bank heist episode of The X-Files. If I'm getting that wrong, it definitely was for a bank heist. And I'm not remembering then correctly what the production was. But you can see that the old ticketing concourse looks like what you would find is like an East Coast, especially bank.
Yeah, right? With the pillars, the kiosks. Well, I'm counting hundreds of them. Well, maybe not. 25, 30?
So the last, I guess, of the great train stations built... In the U.S.
Yes, for sure. This still operates as a train station, as a great train station. And if the future holds, it'll have more trains plus the Hyperloop. Elon Musk's Hyperloop wants to launch from here to get to San Francisco in 30 minutes.
Is he still allowed to be a part of that? I'm so confused about what's going on with him and the SEC.
Oh, my God. The poor guy is bipolar. So during his manic stages, he gets a lot done. And during his depressive stages, he's tweeting irresponsibly. So, you know, all of that, you have to take into consideration.
Oh, my God. I can't believe that the present government came down on someone tweeting inappropriately.
How ironic. The irony is so delicious.
All right, well, it says please do not enter, so let's go somewhere else. I want to look at the old Harvey House, the last of the great Harvey houses built by Mr. Harvey.
Uh-huh.
These were a chain of restaurants that were built at the train stations. There's a wonderfully historic one over in Barstow, I think it is. Route 66. One of the big historic landmarks off Route 66 in that part of the state. Again, for many years, this Harvey House, just outside...
Let's go look.
...was a film location
for?
And sat unused as a restaurant, but just would be available for private events and as a filming location.
What?
And now it has been refurbished, restored, and the grand opening of the new restaurant there has either just taken place or is about to take place.
You're kidding. This has been sealed up for so long. I didn't
exactly.
know that was...
Exactly.
Because when you walk, it's on your right when you're coming in through the plaza. Now we step out in the plaza. Note the sound difference. Now, this was... look at this place. That is fantastic. This was... this you couldn't even access before. How did I not see that? That's amazing. Look at entrance. It says exit twice, but one is entrance, one is no entrance. Hey, look at that arch window. How many stories is that arch window, Phil?
Three?
Three. A three-story arch window. It looks open. Dare we go in?
No.
No. It's just the staff.
But so it has been restored,
yeah.
And look at the beautiful clock
Locks
over on the...
Fantastic.
Am I may be incorrect in thinking this. I've seen it recently. I have this crazy idea that this is the lobby of the theater in Inglourious Basterds.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But it
where
but
the machine guns happen
it gets
on the
used
other.
A lot. I mean, yeah. I one of my favorite scenes in a in an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. episode was filmed here. Just to name a few.
Just to name a few.
But I took a tour of this Harvey House several years ago when it was, you know, unoccupied, not
right.
used, and they were still pretty lovingly maintaining it, including the bathrooms, which were fantastic exemplars of Art Deco.
Wow. See, well, that's the thing. A lot of these places you think are abandoned when, in fact, they're making great money of locations in filming. So you got to say, well, for all of Hollywood being a pain in the ass, how much have they kept historic things alive by paying rent on it when they didn't have regular consumers in it?
And literally, sometimes Hollywood allowed these things to stay standing. I mean, I've told you about... how the Ennis House, right? Again,
yeah.
Blade Runner, Rick Deckard's apartment, and used so famously as Asian villains' lairs that a South Park episode is set there as the headquarters of an Asian gang. But 17 episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation filmed there. Every episode of the original run of Twin Peaks had something shot in the Ennis House. And for a longest time, because it's a Frank Lloyd Wright house, and he was a brilliant architect and a terrible, terrible contractor,
right.
That house has wanted to come down every year since it was built, and the cost of just maintaining it
just
and keeping
it up yeah.
is so exorbitant that you either have to be a billionaire, like the current owner, who's trying to get rid of that money trap himself, or you have to rent it out nonstop,
right?
In order just to pay the regular construction and repair and maintenance on it.
Isn't the original owners, apparently they didn't divorce, even though they hated each other because they both wanted to maintain the house?
I don't know. I do know that the Ennises never lived there. Like
right.
so many of Frank Lloyd Wright's houses,
no,
people who hired him, the relationship with Wright and the clients... ended up going bad.
Right.
And no one ended up living there.
But the piece itself was iconic and so influential on so many other housings, so many other architectural pieces.
So you...
Now we're heading deeper.
Look at those doors, the entrance, the streamliner. Isn't that amazing?
Rushed copper doors. Wait till the patina gets on that sucker. Okay, so that's the water commission over there, right?
Yeah, the department, the Metropolitan Water District.
Right, the classic from Chinatown, of course.
One of my groomsmen who will be joining us for a fantastic adventure at the Lost Spirits Distillery.
Yes.
His office is up there overlooking
fantastic.
Us right now. So have you ever seen this, the old border?
No, look at this. So it's a brick thing in the ground with brass. It says Chinatown Boundary, 1887.
And you can see it stretch on and where it goes, yes. So this, where we are standing, and where Union Station now sits, as you point out, was where Chinatown originally was.
Right.
And it was utterly lawless.
Yes.
I mean, hence the line in the movie Chinatown. Forget about it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
You could see stuff from it from Chaplin's The Kid and Easy Street, another short, where he used the Chinatown location as the back streets of, I guess it was supposed to be London back in the day, supposedly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but definitely The Kid, where they're breaking glass and they're running around, so the little kid breaks the glass and then he comes in as a glass repairer. All of that is shot in the original Chinatown with the gravel unpaved streets and the weird... none of the blocks actually were square blocks.
Wow.
Yeah, so if you watch The Kid again, particularly where they're breaking the windows, all of that is original Chinatown.
So this gets lifted and moved because right behind Chinatown is the river, which also was diverted at one point.
Yeah.
But this was the perfect land upon which to build the train station. So guess what, Chinatown?
You got to go.
You got to get out.
Well, because the original train station was over where Skid Row is now, which is why Skid Row is where it is, because all the hobos would get on the boxcars and land in the warmest part of the country in the winter, which was right there where Skid Row is now. So traditionally, 1856, that's where the train terminated over on in between Wall and San Pedro. And then when they moved in 32, the idea was to get out of that derelict district in the Depression era.
Do I see a Jedi? Is that a Jedi, an actual Jedi?
No, is a nun. There's a convent nearby.
Oh, okay. All right. Hey, speaking of The Kid and early Hollywood, there's an early Hollywood classic that I want to discuss with you, so maybe we could step out of the hot sun for
a
second.
Let's get in some shade.
I have to tell this whole Dialing for Dollars story again.
Please do. Oh, my goodness. It's a good one.
No, it's not really. When I was elementary school, I come home from school sick early one day. Yeah. And I remember this going, oh, good, I'm in time for Dialing for Dollars.
Yeah, you could win.
Like 1 p.m., I get to watch a classic movie and I could win. And I've never seen this classic film before. I had heard of it even as a kid because One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest had come out and became the second film ever to sweep all the major Oscars. No film had done that. Actor, actress, director, screenplay, best picture. No film had won all of those in 40 years.
Right.
Before... One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And the original film to do it was It Happened One Night.
Right.
And so as a kid, I sit down to watch this, and there's this famous scene where Clark Gable gets undressed, revealing he's not wearing an undershirt.
Right.
Overnight.
The undershirt sales dropped 40%.
Plummet. Yeah.
Plummet. And after that, no guy ever wore an undershirt again, really.
And I want to talk about that scene later in that scene, but... I didn't see that scene or anything thereafter because by the time that happened, I was out like a light.
Yeah, you were sick, for God's
sake. Taking an afternoon nap.
Right.
And I don't catch up to this film until now. And I'm wondering why, because I'm not the biggest fan of Frank Capra. Though I always did love Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yes, absolutely. He's connected to the common man, that fella.
Is he? I guess he is. I guess Frank Capra is because... the truth is, you find out that It Happened One Night, even though it wins all those Oscars the year it comes out, it's not a pretty big hit upon its initial release.
Right.
It isn't until it goes to the sticks, as they were called,
right,
small town, rural America, that it ends up becoming a hit.
Right, because it's a lot of the issues of hitchhiking was involved there, which was common, not in the big cities, but out in
the Depression. 1934, 35, right around there.
And it's a comedy about a guy and a girl that have to share a room and put a little sheet up between them. All this awkwardness.
Well, a rich heiress.
Yes, she's
who
a rich
does
heiress.
Not have access to her fortunes at that time, so she's experiencing what life is like for everybody else.
Right, exactly.
And
Clark Gable's a no-nonsense tough guy.
He's a reporter. Yeah.
And they fall in love as they journey across the backcountry of
America. He goes very quickly from being someone who's kind of mocking tough guys, which is what's delightful,
yep.
and which is what makes the first kind of 10 minutes of the movie so funny, to being someone who's incredibly misogynistic and tough when it comes to treating women with any kind of respect.
Ah, yeah. Well, it was the 30s, after all, wasn't
okay.
it?
Okay. So I did not... This movie gets dark quickly, in other words, in a way that... one of the reasons I don't like Frank Capra is I find that when he goes to the darkness in his movies before the big redemption,
right,
he does so as a tourist.
Ah, interesting. Yes.
And there's some of that in It Happened One Night.
Yeah, he's viewing it from a distance of the camera, probably.
Even the dirtiness is very clean.
Right.
It's very neat. It's,
yeah, it's
fossil.
Very studioized.
It's very fantasized. Yes.
Yeah.
And so there are other filmmakers of the age that I thought were better satirical commenters on really what was going on.
I get that.
But this film has lived long enough where it actually is really dark.
Yes.
But it's really dark because it's something that should never be shown, especially in the wake of Me Too.
I guess that's true. You know, now that I'm thinking about it, it's all just in the filter of, oh, it's a fun comedy, and you're right. There is horrible gender inequality throughout the whole thing.
And just controlling, the yeah. absolute controlling and domination.
Right, except for the one scene where he can't pick up a ride on hitchhiking and she gets a car to stop by showing her leg. So then the car stops.
Which is still
I know.
Something that
well,
reduces this, her.
Reduces
it,
her.
It says that women's only power is this, and oh, by the way, it only serves the power to get them picked up by someone who's going to rob them blind.
Right.
That's who's right. out to exploit them.
Right.
So again, exploitation leads to greater exploitation. it's fascinating to me because, you know, look, my sister and my mom once had this very interesting conversation, a political conversation they were having. Well, it wasn't interesting until my mom asked one question that really made my ears perk up. But they were in this debate over the founding fathers.
Okay.
And or about something, you know, sometime. And my mom discrediting them, whoever they were talking about, because of being slave owners. And my sister then points out, well, so many of the framers of the Constitution were slave owners. We can't apply our current contextual views onto them in judging them.
Right.
And my mom listened to that and said, why not?
Right.
And
why has time been the cushion?
Yeah, why can't we?
Yeah.
Why can't we?
And it's the same with these movies, right?
And why it's the same with these movies, yeah.
And it's true. You said the same thing with Philadelphia Experiment.
Oh, no, not Philadelphia Experiment. Philadelphia Experiment is the movie where people go back in time.
Yeah,
my Philadelphia Experiment would be me going back in time to redo the gender politics in Philadelphia story.
That's right, because you don't know who to root for. That's so true. So, awesome. So It Happened One Night, made the big deal. And, of course, you know how that was considered a B-movie, because that was filmed at, was that Paramount or was that MGM?
It was Columbia. Yeah.
So Columbia was a low movie house, and Clark Gable was on loan from his contract at, I'm going to say, Warner Brothers. And the reason he had to do it was he was in a drunk driving car accident. He made a right coming off a party out of Laurel Canyon onto Sunset Boulevard, struck and killed a pedestrian, and the studio overnight went in, did damage control, stunk him out of there. Put in an executive in the driver's seat who had to do 6 months of hard time, and as punishment, he had to do It Happened One Night for Columbia.
We heard this story actually at the Breakfast Club. That's really interesting. Yeah.
You did? Somebody told that story?
And I never realized that, right, this was that movie.
Yeah.
So you got that going on around. Is it any wonder that the aftertaste of this film is kind of not all right?
And but considering everybody got an Oscar out of it.
Well, okay. Claudette Colbert.
Yes.
This is a fascinating story to me, and I want to know the real story, but I don't know if we'll ever be able to find out. But here we are at Union Station.
Yeah.
Where Claudette Colbert was when she won her Oscar. She was here at Union Station getting the hell out of town.
Oh, that's...
Her reason was, oh, I don't think I have any chance to win, so I'm not going to attend.
Right.
Because there's no reason why you would attend, oh, I don't know, to support all your colleagues who were nominated for that film also.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So that seems a weird excuse. I'm not going to win, so I'm not going to be there.
Get the hell out of here.
But also, not only am I not going to be there, I'm going to get out of town.
I know. At least Joan Crawford would just stay at her house in Beverly Hills on Oscar night.
So because it was a different Los Angeles,
yeah.
Not nearly the traffic, right. She wins early in the evening, and Harry Cohn, the legendary, what's the word that you use? Infamous, I guess.
Infamous?
There's been a lot of dark characters in Hollywood history. Harry Cohn is certainly one of them. He is infamous. And, you know, the legendary story, I think the line is attributed to Billy Wilder, but when Harry Cohn died, the funeral saw a more massive turnout than there had ever been at any Hollywood funeral, and Billy Wilder said, well, if you give the people what they want.
Right. Classic.
Anyway, Claudette Colbert wins her Oscar early in the evening. Harry Cohn sends operatives. It's literally like the movie itself with Harry Cohn playing her dad.
Right.
Harry Cohn sends private operatives to track her down at Union Station. She is dragged off a train and forced to come to the Oscar ceremony.
Wow.
To accept it in person.
And so the Oscars at that time were just over at the Biltmore Hotel, which I'm sure we're going to walk by, right by Pershing Square. Because that would have been 19...
They wouldn't have been at the Roosevelt, I guess, in Hollywood? No.
Roosevelt was 29, then in the 30s it came to the Biltmore, and then 40s back into Hollywood, and then once the Pantages Theater was opened in 48, I'm
going to... So she's that close.
She's that
close. Doesn't even think of stopping by just to see. I'm not going to win. Like, doesn't even think that... So there's more to this story.
There is.
I feel.
Yeah. Anyway. I know. Now that you mention it, that's a pretty weird. I've always heard that story, but now if you put the motivations behind it, there's a lot more something going on.
I have a real hard time with a lot of the supposedly great films of the 1930s for this reason, for what we're discussing about how it just is. Does not seem appropriate to be watching them. And whereas you get to the 1940s and you're incorporating so much psychology into the mix that now, even when you're depicting some of this behavior, you're getting down towards the dark psychological themes underneath it.
Well, and this is the rise of the idea of the consciousness and unconsciousness in Sigmund Freud's books around that time, even though they were written in, 1910s?
And then the influence of German Expressionism.
All of that comes up at the same time. So then we start putting that in our artwork, that there's a second layer, as opposed to, say, the silent comedies, which was just a superficial fun time, crazy, wacky physical comedy, storytelling as a very simple montage of images.
Yeah.
And then once we get into this darker psychological thing, a lot of things come up that may or may not be appropriate to express.
I was jotting down some ideas, some notes. I was asked about, like, what do I consider the best decade of American film? And I was just jotting down some notes trying to figure out, well, how do you assess it? Is it how many great movies it is? Is it just the greatest of the bunch? What are you doing?
Yeah.
And I know I knew this, but it really is fascinating because I think the 1940s is certainly one of the great decades. And yet I'm looking at this and it suddenly occurs to me in a way it never had before. There are no people of color in any of these movies.
Isn't that true?
And of course there weren't. I mean, but just to realize that versus where we are now and where we were then, and how many of my favorite performers of the last 20, 30 years are performers of color, and yet, boy, there were decades when you never even saw them, except maybe for very small bit parts.
Where it's specific to the story.
Where it's specific to the story, like in It Happened One Night.
Right.
I think it's a Porter, maybe, that comes out. And the thing is, what I realized when I exhaled that the scene with the African-American actor wasn't offensive, I realized when I watch old movies and a performer of color comes on, I do clench up because I automatically expect it's going to be really
something unfortunate. Yes, that there's going to be some cultural bias from the time that's going to make its way into the dialogue and the scripting and the shooting. Yes.
So, thank God.
Fantastic.
Hey, I was thinking we might march across Alameda, go to Olvera Street.
Oh, yes.
To look at a mural I don't know if you've seen.
Oh, is it recent?
It is a very old mural. That was believed lost for many, many, many decades.
Shut up.
And during renovations was discovered.
Oh, let's go look.
Because it was supposed to be destroyed. So we're climbing the secret staircase to the secret Siqueiros mural designed in 1932 to commemorate the start of the Los Angeles Olympic Games.
Yes, a big deal back then.
To celebrate the history of Los Angeles.
Right.
And after getting his design approved, the artist, under cover of darkness, went in and added some pieces to drive home his theme that all of Western civilization, at least here in North America, is based upon the exploitation of indigenous peoples and cultures.
Holy crap. Okay, so it's pretty faded, I'm surprised. But you see the...
Well, it was painted over.
It was painted over. Whitewashed.
And see how they built this...
cover for it.
To protect it from the elements,
So how did they get... they had to carefully remove the white paint and not take out so much of the actual pigments that he put down in 32, right?
Well, you would know more about that process than I would.
Yeah. I would, actually, because it's actually two different paints. So if they used a white latex and he painted it in oil... It's kind of easy to separate. However, if you have two of the same mediums, they can actually bond chemically, so it might be a little trickier.
I mean, I love that you've got the
crucified
indigenous person. You've got the soldiers ready to shoot him if he doesn't die.
This is a tree of some sort, a tropical jungle. Oh, I see, the Sebia tree. Oh, isn't this handy? So I have a little picture of the mural I'm looking at. The mural is about, what, was that 100, 150 feet away?
Yeah.
On the rooftop. But then it has a much better picture, an original, 1932. I take it that's the artist standing there, or is that a woman? Maybe that's the artist. It's hard to say. But there they are standing at the very position in the 1932 photograph, black and white. But then all the images has a little arrow and explaining what the images are. And so it was whitewashed in 34.
Partly whitewashed in 34, completely whitewashed in 38.
And then it took from 71 to 2012 to conserve, protect, document, and reopen.
And then this reopens in 2012, and you were still here.
Yeah.
And we don't know it.
And never knew it.
Because you can't drive down. All you can see if you're driving past is this little white roof.
Yeah.
Which just seems like, oh, God, they're messing with the architecture of Olvera Street.
I know. We were doing this podcast downtown in 2012. We'd never heard of this.
See, and that's what's so much fun. Even as Los Angeles and downtown L.A. Has this just this never-ending construction boom.
Right, the growth.
And renovations and gentrifications. Little gems
like this
keep revealing themselves.
Amazing. Yeah. So I guess he must have added the crucifix as a final piece.
Right.
That would be the most controversial of all the images. And then he probably put the soldiers on top there, look like an additional.
Right, that was an additional. You're right.
Yeah, and so, but then everything else, because it didn't look like, well, I guess those figures seem to be balanced in there. But that, to me, is the biggest... Holy crap, in 1932, that would freak
everybody
out.
Can you imagine that if he didn't have the figure and it was just a cross, it was like, celebration of the of Christianity.
Yes, of the Jesuits landing here in 1781 at the nearby river spot. This is theoretically where Los Angeles started.
I mentioned last week about my celebration of Leo Carrillo at the Breakfast Club, whose great-great-grandfather was part of the Portola expedition, in the 1780s. He marries obviously Carrillo's great-grandmother. The marriage is performed by Father Junipero Serra.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that gives you some California lineage.
That's
right
some
there.
California lineage,
anyway,
right?
All right, let's go. One other thing about this that's kind of fun. There is, beneath that building where the mural is on the side,
yeah,
and beneath where the protective, covering it has been built,
yeah,
down below it is, it may not be open yet, but it will be soon, a museum about the history of water in Los Angeles. We just mentioned that we were near the Metropolitan Water District.
Yeah.
And what is amazing is they had to build those support stanchions down all the way into the earth.
Right.
And for a variety of, you know, earthquake seismic reasons.
Absolutely.
And so that's why they wondered, well, what can we do with this space now that has these posts coming down through the middle of it? Oh, well, here's something we can do. And lo and behold, when they are burying these stanchions and connecting them deep into the earth, what do they discover but a remnant of the original diversion pipe that rerouted the LA River?
Wow. That's so fast to get the fresh water. So technically, what are we from the river here? About a mile, I would say, less than a mile.
But again,
it was rerouted.
It was rerouted down
there. So it was never. That's the Army Corps of Engineers building that cement thing that you see the car race in Greece, for instance, or the ants in them,
right,
1954. So it was the Army Corps of Engineers after some flooding and erosion that happened, I think it was in late 30s, early 40s, that they decided to cement the entire river as a way of preventing more flooding and more ground erosion.
All right.
How cool is this?
Okay, so we are across the street from a reminder to me of Los Angeles as retrofuturism. We're by the back entrance of the old Times building. Oh, the courthouse, I see. All right.
The courthouse here. City Hall is directly in front of us.
This, the wind is just stopping here and see if... So what is this sculpture? Well, so I call it retrofuturism.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the right term.
That's not the right term.
But in the 1960s, people would design these things that were so much like...
We just recorded an accident.
Yeah, we did record an accident. And did everybody just drive off?
Yeah, they just drove off.
Oh, my God.
And there you go.
That's what you do in L.A. If you're in an accident, just honk and move on.
That's right.
But they would design these things that seemed at the time so futuristic. Like this would be something I would expect to decorate Autopia at Disneyland.
Well, exactly. This was the idea of your future and the futurism and also the worry about the urban landscape. You know, you think about all those movies like Charlton Heston in Omega Man.
This is what I think of.
And this idea that art and that your decay has no end, that there's no upswing to it. Because we only learned that urbanism was a phenomenon of the 1920s, so we didn't know the cycle of urbanism, that it recycles itself. We just thought that it grows and then it decays to a horrible dystopian end. So a lot of this artwork was to both exemplify a future, but also try light up the darkness. And so this is a series of lights. You could see those were originally just incandescent bulbs. I think they're all LED now. And then that ladybug thing that's hanging in the center is actually a speaker that would play a musical score. Now, the musical score would be this loop that would be very loud, that would go on continuously, so much so that a judge here in the county court not only said turn that off, but passed a law that made it illegal for that thing to operate as the artist originally intended. So it was an illegal piece of artwork for the longest time, and only they turned the sound back on, I think 2014, it went on for a couple of weeks, and then everybody hated it again, and it was irritating, and City Hall bitched about it, so they turned it back off. So it's an art piece that you look at, and it's not fully functioning because that musical score has only played maybe once, 8 months in total
And it denotes a below-ground shopping mall.
Yeah, well, there is a shopping mall below it. I don't know if it's denoting it. I don't think it's trying to point
but
at it.
But that was always a thing for me as a kid, was when I would see that, I would know that there was this below-ground shopping mall. Like, in the future, everything... Well, because everything would be irradiated.
Right.
So you wouldn't want to go to a Quiznos above ground.
Right. Your sidewalks were unsafe. There was homeless, there was scary things, so that you would place everything... all your shopping, all your community events, either underground or if you look at the old Macy's place on 7th, how that looks like a prison. There's no windows on the outside. They're out, now they're sticking them in because they realize that pedestrian traffic requires pedestrian interaction with your architecture.
But, well, also, you used to go to a mall to escape the urban environment.
Right, right.
And now you come downtown because you want to be a part of the urban environment.
Right.
So they blow up that Macy's Plaza to open it up so that it's more open air so that you can be a part of all the excitement going on around you.
Exactly.
Rather than fleeing it below ground with the mole people, which is what we were being
told
to do. Right. The only other places, I mean, I think there's some places like that in San Francisco, but really, Tokyo is the one where, like, you go down to any subway stop and there's a gigantic shopping mall. Like, there's a shoe store.
Every underground. But it's all underground. Montreal's like that too, but that's weather related.
So I mean, where are we? We're near the top?
Yes, almost the top. We're on the 26th floor of City Hall, where every mayor has his portrait painted since, 1852? This is Mayor John C. Nichols. And this is where the tour starts. I think maybe that one might be older, but it goes sort of in sequential order. Each mayor every... it seems every year they get a new mayor.
It's called the Hall of Beards, and you get to see facial hair through the years.
Well, they all do look like hipsters, don't they? This one, 1855, so I take it this is our first mayor, Mayor Thomas Foster. You know, as a dentist.
He was a physician.
Yes.
As major concern to him, Mayor Thomas Foster... was the development and improvement of water, sewer, and educational facilities. In 1855, a two-story brick schoolhouse known as School Number 1 on Spring and 2nd Street
was opened.
Wow.
Look at that. So 1855, so you think about that. So that's just 5 years after the Congress did the Grand Compromise, which was California would be a free state, and Texas was allowed to maintain the slave trade. So there were slaves in Texas if California wouldn't have slavery, which is how Biddy Mason came here and became the first...
I didn't know Texas was a slave state. Aren't you talking about the Missouri Compromise? Is that what you're talking about?
No, it was, I don't think it was Missouri. I thought I read it as Texas when I was studying Biddy Mason story.
That sound we hear are people typing corrections to us right now.
Yes, if anybody, we don't have the access to the computer here on the 26th floor of City Hall, so we'll have to determine. But look at that. I love the quality of the paintings, too, here. These are oil on canvas, done by some of the most famous of the great portrait painters through the years. This is a Frederick Mielsen, renowned for his... thick brushwork. Look at how quick it's done.
And speaking of thick brushwork, yes. Quite a beard on Mayor Henry Mellis, but no mustache.
No mustache. That's right. It's the chops, the mutton chops. And he's also, look at that double-breasted peacoat.
I was going to say, it's almost military in attire. And here it is, 1860, the start of the Civil War.
Yeah, I know. Interesting. Right? Good look on that. Here's the next mayor's beardless. Jose.
Yeah, beardless.
Mascaral. That's very Spanish. Of course, I don't know my mayors of the 1860s that well, other than these portraits that you can see through time. Look at that. Ooh, that little problem with the body handwork relationship. I get the faces all right, but his technique.
He's talking about the painting.
Yes. And, who could forget Prudent Beaudry, 1874 to 1876.
So Prudent Beaudry served in between two terms of James R. Toberman.
Oddly enough, he's Canadian. Look at that. And the director of the First National Bank in Los Angeles.
Wow, not even a citizen.
Not even a citizen. Well, they were running low on the mayors back then. Here we are in 1876 with Frederick Madouille.
This is not a good painting either.
It's not a good portrait at all. Tough to find good portrait artists at the end of the Civil War, I guess. Didn't it end in 1876?
I'm no, 65.
Right. Thank you.
They were all killed.
Oh, yeah.
They were killed. I mean,
painting on the battlefield back then. So you know how it works.
Because, I mean, they would try to take photos. I mean, there are battlefield photographs. But if they were in a hurry, they would paint the scene.
Yes, because it took so long to do that. So here, he's born in Ireland. This is Edward F. Spence, 1884 to 86 mayor, and also a Los Angeles banker.
What's odd to me is how few of these names I have heard.
Yeah, right? The mayors don't. I mean, we know Thomas Bradley because of the airport. We know Hahn because of the Hahn building. If you don't get a building named after you. Oh, Henry Hazard, we know because of water hazards in the golf course. I'm kidding. That's not actually the case.
Oh, that would be good.
If that were true.
He supervised over the city when the oil boom started, when the oil was discovered.
Look at this portrait technique. So here he's clearly outlined in some sort of pencil, just the silhouette, which suggests that this is what they call the shadow painting at the time. You stood your person in front of a light, and then you outlined their shadow, and then just filled in the details for keeping your proportions correct.
It's both his look and the style is reminiscent, actually, of some Teddy Roosevelt kind of.
Yeah, right? Like this one here. Ooh, Thomas Rowan's eyes are scary.
The portrait's nowhere near as good.
Right.
But how similar do these guys look?
I know, right? With the same Wilford Brimley mustache. And a
lot of fiber.
And there was a lot. Look at, they got the little tie clip even identical.
This is fascinating, actually.
Isn't it? And the portraits, I always like it to see, there's always so much pressure when you have to paint a political figure. And you see some artists rise to the occasion and some completely collapse under the weight of all that.
I can't believe they got away with some of the ones we're seeing, actually.
Well, again, what do you do at the unveiling?
Now, Bryson is a name.
Mayor John Bryson of 1888 to 89.
Bryson. Isn't there a Bryson building?
Ah, there is a Bryson building. Yes, in downtown L.A. Yeah. But is it this fellow that got it named after him?
We don't know, but that is a name that I've heard. There we go. Mayor Fred Eaton.
Now, we're sparing our audience from reading the paragraph about their whole career and their tenure. So if you are interested, please come to the 26th floor downtown.
Join us. We'll still be here.
We'll still be here. And it's completely free, we should point out, other than having to go through security and forgetting your sunglasses.
I chose the full body search.
You did?
Yeah.
That is request only, of course. There. Wow, look at how scary George Alexander looks here just before World War I.
That's a portrait, right?
That's
there.
A portrait. You see some wisdom there, but there's also a little bit of sinisterness in that blue eyes of his. And that Colonel Sanders beard doesn't help any of that sinisterness.
Mayor Henry Rose?
He seems very modern. That's a very modern look.
Oh, but wait till we get over here.
Oh, yes. This portrait.
Mayor Charles Sebastian. Now, people need to look up Mayor Charles Sebastian because this guy.
Yeah. He was a patrolman with the police and rose to rank of chief. And then while running for office of mayor, he became embroiled in charges which he was acquitted. He resigned as mayor due to the adverse publicity resulting from the publication of letters damaging and of a personal nature. During his short term, the suburbs of the Palms and the greater portion of San Fernando Valley were annexed in 1950.
I lived in the Palms.
That's a great portrait, though. We're now in the unfortunate school tour. Oh, look at
the unfortunate school? How do you go to the unfortunate school?
So this is my favorite here. It's Mr. Frank Shaw, Mayor Frank Shaw.
Oh, sure,
Mayor
Shaw.
And just 1933, when Hitler rose to power. What's his mustache?
Oh, no. It's unfortunate. You know, Mayor Shaw would come to the Breakfast Club regularly.
Would he?
And it is interesting how in some of the documentation, some of the, you know, because we have all the minutes from every meeting through the years, and in some of the recordings that survive of the radio shows, there's a little bit of a fondness expressed from time to time
no.
of what's going on in Germany.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, no. That's
hey,
terrible.
Look, as we've talked about before, Henry Ford was a big, big fan.
Economic
big fan.
Turnaround. I mean, it was
and,
industrialization.
He was an honorary member of that there.
Party.
Yeah, the controlling party. Their name escapes me.
Right?
Yeah.
Fantastic. And then here we get to Porter. So this is also pre-war. Here I love the thick brushwork of the portrait. See how it's just chunks. You can see how it's rendered, not smoothly, but very rough.
Why does Mayor John Porter get a portrait twice as big as anyone else's?
Well, I guess this is, you know, what you're famous for. Of course, he saw the Olympics.
Oh.
So he was instrumental, including if you, that famous picture of the Graf Zeppelin touching here to... Have you ever seen that photo? There's a giant Zeppelin that is moored to the top of City Hall.
Makes me nervous. I'm already not able to look out the window.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, right. I forgot you're scared of heights. Wait till we get upstairs.
No, this is not so bad.
No,
I mean,
I know.
I've gotten to the point where I can get... I mean, I'm feeling myself a little woozy, but...
okay.
Well, but it isn't until we get to, like, floor 60 that I'm really...
Oh, yeah, but no, floor 27 here is going to be a woozy experience.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's see.
Mayor Fletcher Bowron.
Mayor Fletcher had to deal with our first smog problem.
Ooh.
Yes, back in the 40s, right? And,
you know, that was always the idea, as I understand it, of the third in the Chinatown trilogy. That originally Robert Towne had envisioned it as three major ecological turning points in Los Angeles history. The bringing of the water to the valley
right.
in Chinatown. The discovery of oil under the valley
in the
the Two Jakes in the 1940s there. Yeah. And then in the 1950s, the discovery of smog.
Right. Isn't that something? That smog became a problem. Particularly if that terrible two-week inversion in London, when Churchill ignored all the problems and his own assistant was hit by a bus because the smog was so thick, and movies had to be canceled because the smog, because everybody was burning coal, but there was a high pressure holding all the low pressure down, and it didn't dissipate. So the power plant kept going, everybody was burning coal, and they estimated from the lung problems about 35,000.
I had heard that.
Yeah.
Though this is the first time I've ever heard that being blamed for the smog problems in Los Angeles.
Well, it began the environmental movement worldwide.
You're blaming London on what happens here. Like a true Canadian, you're blaming
everything else.
The Queen.
Here's Riordan. We know Riordan because he owns the pantry.
Riordan. Well, he is airbrushed within an inch of his life in that photo.
Yeah, this is a photo, right?
So he? No, it's a painting.
Yeah,
but
it's a photograph.
Oh,
portrait photograph.
He owns the pantry, mm-hmm. and fascinating guy. He was being poised to run for governor when Schwarzenegger became governor.
Oh, I didn't know
because
that.
Remember, our governor, Gray Davis, was recalled. There was a recall election, which was really sketchy because there was no whiff of him doing anything inappropriate.
No,
it was just...
somebody else wanted in.
Yeah, they basically said, he's done an incompetent job because he actually did not get correct accounting reports from the state. So he was undercut. And a year later, a year after being reelected, when Enron was using California as a
scapegoat
ATM machine and shutting down our grids. Anyway, a move was put forward to recall Gray Davis, and former Mayor Reardon was reluctant to sign off on that because he said, you know, there is a way to get people out of office. You vote them out of office.
Yeah.
If they haven't done anything wrong, illegal, why are we recalling? That is a dangerous slope. And finally they said, look, if you will sign off on this, you will be our choice to replace him. So he goes, okay. And the guy that talks him into doing it is Schwarzenegger. And lo and behold, as soon as the recall goes, then isn't Reardon shocked to find Schwarzenegger go on The Tonight Show to announce he's running for governor?
Here's this is Villaraigosa. Look at that.
Yeah, Mayor Villaraigosa.
Yeah, so what an interesting technique here. It's almost pointillism to a degree. And it seems like it's, is that pastel? That looks like it might be I can't really read that name, Ortiz. But that is a fascinating portrait of him, and well done. Here's Tom Bradley over in the corner, of course.
Mayor Bradley. I mean, he was longtime mayor of Los Angeles, wasn't he?
Yeah.
20 years.
20 years running this town. And what a great portrait that is. The hands have a little foreshortening problem, but, you know, the hands are also very difficult to do. But you see both joy of a job well done in those eyes, and the sternness of what it takes to run this town. And he's got a whole airport named after him, or a wing.
He does, yeah, the international terminal.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, here's some earlier fellas. But that's the one I like, always. What's this, 53? And then how old is this one? This one looks really ancient. Yeah, 52.
So speaking of the 1970s, Mayor Bradley, when he takes over, and London.
Yeah.
I finally saw what many people consider to be the last great Hitchcock masterpiece, Frenzy.
Oh, Frenzy.
1972.
I thought you were going to bring up Topaz again.
No. What an interesting film Frenzy is, and, you know, it's about a serial killer, the necktie killer.
Yes, of course.
And Hitchcock wanted Michael Caine to play that part, and Michael Caine rejected it, said, this part's disgusting, I won't do it. Ends up casting Barry Foster, who's a really interesting, all the actors in it, Alec McCown, John Finch, they're all really, really good actors who would do a lot of work, but none of them were names, none of them were recognizable faces, and never became that. And it actually plays to the film's benefit,
right.
I think. Because it really reveals both the strengths of Hitchcock and the weaknesses of Hitchcock.
Oh.
It reveals how much he relied on, again, stars that you had a built-in empathy for.
Right.
Because, again, if the first Jimmy Stewart movie you ever see is Vertigo, you hate that guy.
Yeah, that's right.
Or Rear Window. He's so abusive
to
Grace Kelly. These characters are so dark, and he rejoiced, Hitchcock, in taking these beloved actors and pushing them into the darkness as far as he possibly could without losing the audience's affection for
them.
But so here's a movie where he doesn't have stars. He doesn't have anybody recognizable with any built-in affection. And so it's really interesting because for a lot of this movie, you hate the guy who's being wrongly accused, and you enjoy the guy who did it.
Right. Yeah.
And
isn't that fascinating? And Friends, wait, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the famous shot where she invites in the necktie strangler, and the camera stays outside the door, and the door closes, and then it slowly goes down the stairs backwards out onto the street.
Out onto the street.
Where everybody's back to a normal day.
Yeah.
And it is one of the most dark, chilling single shots without dialogue, of a guy who has just animosity to humanity.
I don't know. I'm sure people made this connection before, but here it is, 1972. John Finch stars in Polanski's Macbeth year before as Macbeth. And actually, I was feeling a real kindred nature between Hitchcock and Polanski in watching this film.
Oh, that's
like that shot that you described is the kind of thing that Polanski would do.
Yes. Yeah, because you think about the darkness of that Macbeth in terms of the blood and just the bleakness of the landscape.
So obviously Rosemary's Baby is more of a comedy.
Yeah.
Though Hitchcock, I mean, Frenzy's a comedy too, written by Anthony Schaefer, who would do Sleuth and Murder on the Orient Express, and so many mysteries.
Right.
So, but the comedy is very in keeping with Hitchcock's macabre sense of humor. But Polanski really drops into that, I think.
Yeah.
In Macbeth and The Tenant.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
of course.
And even some of his later films, I feel like. Bitter Moon is a little Hitchcockian.
I haven't seen Bitter Moon in a long time.
So, anyway.
Hey, want to go upstairs?
Yes, let's go upstairs. I'm going to turn this off right now.
Spoiler alert.